Hello, everybody. I think we're going to start. Okay, so I'm really glad to see everybody here tonight. Having the speaker, Beverly Jacobs, here tonight is quite an honor. And basically, before I say anything more, I'm going to ask, is there anyone here that doesn't understand English, that speaks French? I can't see, there's a light behind me. Okay, so if you do need... Okay, so right in the back there's a woman named Anna who is willing to... She's waving her hand in the corner. She's willing to whisper translate for people in French if they want to sit closer to her and trade a seat with someone. Si tu parles pas anglais, tu comprends pas anglais. good point, yeah. Il y a une femme qui s'assoit en arrière, Anna, et elle est debout maintenant. Tu peux échanger un siège avec quelqu'un et rapprocher d'elle. Okay, so hopefully that was comprehensible. Okay, so basically before we start, before I introduce, there's just one announcement to be made. If anyone else has an announcement for an event this week, they can do that as well after Drew.
So this is Drew.
Hi, just very quickly, this Wednesday there will be a number of film screenings about the struggles of the community of Barrier Lake. It's an Algonquin community about 5 hours north of Montreal, and their ongoing struggle to basically have rights to the land that they live on. So that's happening this Wednesday at 6:30 p.m. In Leacock Room 26. And that's on the McGill campus. It's sort of right through the gates and up to the left. Also in room 26 of Leacock on Friday, March 20th, that's this coming Friday, a man from Fort Chipewyan, Alberta, will be coming to speak about the tar sands. His name is Mike Mercurdy, and he's actually a former tar sands worker who quit after he saw the destruction that the tar sands were having, both in terms of the local ecology and also in terms of he lost a few different family members at this point to cancer. And there's been a major cancer epidemic in Fort Chipewyan, which is directly downstream from what is going to be the largest industrial project in human history, if it's not stopped. So that's this Friday at 7 p.m. in room 26 of the Leacock building. And there are flyers outside, and they look like this. Thank you.
Okay, I'll also take this opportunity to announce the event that's going on as a part of this series tomorrow night. There's going to be a panel presentation tomorrow night as well at Atwater Library at 6 p.m., Beverly Jacobs will be there as well as two other women that are here tonight as well, Bridget Tolley and Sue Martin, who both came, one from Ottawa, one from Kitigan-Zeeby, 4 hours from here, and they're all going to speak. Ellen Gabriel will also be present. She's the president of Quebec Native Women, as well as another woman, Laura Yogic, from Kitigan-Zeeby as well. They'll share their personal stories and open up for questions as well. And that will be followed by a vigil at Atwater Park, also known as Cabot Square, which is right at the corner of St. Catherine and Atwater. There are flyers outside on the table if anyone needs to remember or doesn't want to write it down. So without further ado, oh, one more thing, yes. There's a donation box outside on the table as well if anyone wants to leave donations. These things cost a bit of money to put on. And I'd also like to thank all those that supported this event through helping with funding. The 2110 Center for Gender Advocacy, which has a table outside, is one of them. CUPERG Concordia, the Women's Studies Student Association at Concordia, the Simone de Beauvoir Institute, and CKUT. If I'm forgetting anyone, they can come lecture me later. Also, I'd like to thank Anna and Eliane for helping with an amazing fundraiser that happened 2 weeks ago as well. So without further ado, I'll introduce Beverly Jacobs, our speaker. I just met Beverly, and I've heard only good things about her until now. She is from Mohawk Nation Bear Clan from Six Nations Grand River. That's in Ontario near Brantford, for those of you that don't know. And she is currently in her second term of serving as president of the Native Women's Association of Canada. And she is also a lawyer by trade, and I'm told a very proud grandmother and mother as well. And she has also done, she was a lead researcher for an Amnesty International study that was put out in 2004 called Stolen Sisters, Discrimination and Violence Against Indigenous Women in Canada. It was quite an amazing report that came out. And she's also done a lot of amazing work for the Native Women's Association's campaign called Sisters in Spirit. I think that was also launched in 2004, and they're geared towards raising awareness about First Nations women in Canada being targets of violence. I only heard Beverly speak once before, and that was on a radio interview quite a while back, but it really struck me because she had a lot of really important things to say, I think, about, well, a lot of things, but one thing that stuck out to me was the things that she had to say about matriarchal cultures being repressed by a lot of Canada's different colonial policies. The main one that one of the more obvious ones being the Indian Act, which is still alive and well today. So without further ado, I think I will leave it for Beverly to speak.
Scano Sotwego, Giaso Gawanki Say, Gayangihaga Nyagwai Shouda, Haudenosaunee. What I said was greetings of peace to you. I'm Mohawk from Six Nations, Bear Clan, and which is part of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. And this is my traditional territory here in Montreal. And so I have to acknowledge my ancestors, as part of the work that we do is, our ancestors come with us actually wherever we go and when we ask them to be there. And it gives us strength, and that's a lot of where I come from. I was born and raised in my community and have been raised also knowing my traditions and my culture and actively participate in my community in our longhouse ceremonies. And that's how I was raised. I was raised with a very political family, having chiefs and clan mothers as my uncles and grandmothers. And so I have a lot of knowledge in being taught very strongly about my tradition and very strict and how I've been raised. And so that's what I carry with me and I hold with me when I do the work that I do. And so I'd like to acknowledge Maya for being able to organize such a powerful event and being successful in bringing so many people together, and the people that had helped her to organize this. I also need to acknowledge Kevin Daniels, who is also here. He's the leader for the Congress of Aboriginal Peoples, and the women who brought me here. We're like a family now. We are a family, and the women, the mothers and daughters of women who, young women and older women who are missing or murdered. And we have formed another family of these women who have gone missing. That'll be the focus tomorrow, specifically on Sisters in Spirit and the missing and murdered Aboriginal women. And so we brought just a very minute number of pictures just to show, the spirits of those women and young women who are also with us when we do this work. And so we have to acknowledge that all of the time. So the focus, actually, of what I'm going to present is on the impacts of colonization on Indigenous women, specifically on our people, but specifically on Indigenous women in this place called Canada. And how, you know, a lot of the impacts that we're dealing with today as Indigenous women, Aboriginal women, is a result of genocidal policies, as a result of trying to get rid of us as a people, to try to assimilate us, because we were in the way of development, of land ownership. And so that's part of what I wanted to discuss. And I want to start out first with... I carry these with me as well when I'm doing presentations. They've been to ceremony too, so they're very, very powerful. What we call knowledge, our knowledge, and that's carried in our wampum belts. This one is very ancient. These are replicas, but these are very ancient wampum belts, this one especially. This one was actually created even before the colonizers came here. And this is called the Women's Nomination Belt. And it represents the roles and responsibilities of women within within our nations. And it goes right back to the Great Law of Peace and the teachings of the Great Law. And I have a very quick question. Those of you who are here in Montreal, how many of you know about the Great Law of Peace? Okay, I'm impressed. Because that is, that Great Law of Peace is our oral history. It it's part of, identifies us, identifies me, and where I come from, and where our traditional territories, it identifies our political, economic, social, educational system. And usually when we start meetings like this, we usually have someone to give the Thanksgiving address, which is... acknowledgement of the Creator and acknowledgement as human beings to be here, acknowledgement to all of the natural world. Sometimes it can take up to an hour just to say the Thanksgiving address itself. And so that's part of what we do in every ceremony and every gathering is this Thanksgiving address. And when we do the recital of the Great Law, and the recital actually of the Great Law hasn't been done in my community probably for at least 10 years now. There was one of our chiefs in our community would recite it, and he's now gone. And so usually when the Great Law is being recited, it takes almost 10 days. 10 days from the beginning, beginning of time for us. We have creation stories that goes right back to how we were created. And so the Great Law, as part of that oral history and where we come from, in the language takes 10 days. And so this is just a very small piece of the recital of the Great Law. And this acknowledgement of the women in our culture, in our matriarchal society. And sometimes when we speak in English, sometimes the words aren't the same as the meaning. And when it's recited in our language, it makes a lot more sense. And sometimes there's a lot of things that are missing. When we do speak in English, And so that's a lot of times the spirit or the spirituality of, you know, of our oral history is a little cut off sometimes because of being able, because when we're thinking in our mind, in our language, and being able to speak in English, there's like a process. And sometimes the words aren't the same, and you can't even translate sometimes the language in English. And so that's part of the difficulty sometimes when we have to translate our oral history into English, and or anything in our language in English, because of the differences in who we are and where we come from and the connections to our lands and our territories. So This original teaching of the peacemaker. So the peacemaker, again, there's a whole story about where he came from and how he was created and how he was born as being the peacemaker through the Creator. And so his messages were delivered from the Creator. And his messages to our people at that time is when our people were warring at that time, where we they say that it's like it was unsafe for anyone. It was unsafe for women. It was unsafe for children. I would say it's much like the way that it is right now, that there's warring and it's just unsafe. And so at this time of the peacemaker was to establish peace in our nations. And this would have occurred a long time before colonization. And so when the peacemaker came into our territory, he was responsible to go to a woman first, and her name was Jigongsase. And Jigongsase actually, where she lived is where present-day Rochester is right now, Rochester, New York. And you can tell where Rochester is, there's a lot of paths that went through her home. And so warriors would pass through her home from one side and another side, and she would feed them. And when she fed them, she would listen to their stories and listen to their war stories. You know, they'd leave and another group would come in and she'd feed them again. And so when the peacemaker came to her and said that women will have a major role to play in our society because of the role of women in our society, and that being life givers, carriers of life, carriers of the spirit of the Creator when we carry our children and give birth to our children. And that's the highest honor to women, is to bring Creator's life, Creator's spirit into this physical world. And because of that inherent characteristic of women, they also have the inherent characteristics of peace, of love, of nurturing, of caring, of looking after their children and being responsible for their children. And so as a result of that, he said that women would hold that responsibility. And he said that although, you know, she was feeding and nurturing these men when they were coming in and warring and, you know, feeding them, he said that that is, you know, the responsibilities of women, of nurturing and feeding, and but she wasn't stopping it. She wasn't stopping them from warring, and so she was just as much as part of the problem because she wasn't stopping them. And so that was his teaching to us as women, is being able to stop that from happening because of those inherent qualities of peace and love and caring. and also told her that women would have a huge responsibility, not only as life givers, but also as decision makers, because of that knowledge and because of that inherent characteristic of being natural leaders. And so what he said was that women would become the heads of clans, would become clan mothers. And being the heads of clans, they had a duty and a responsibility to her clan, her family, and her nation. And as a result of that, and being a clan mother, there's a lot of responsibilities, and he advised what those responsibilities would be. Would be knowing when ceremonies would be, knowing when they would occur, knowing when their children and their grandchildren were being born and naming them, and also choosing the leadership, male leadership. And so they would choose the male chiefs, in our language, actually, is not the right word. Hoyana is the word that we use for that the language that I know, is that it means, Hoyana is men who are of the good. So that means there are certain characteristics of a man to be a leader. And the reason why they said that there would that men could only be chiefs was because of certain characteristics. But there was a balance. There was a balance of the clan mothers being the decision makers and the chiefs, the men, holding that balance. And the women had the responsibility of advising the men of what to say and how to present themselves to external nations. And so as part of that responsibility in being decision makers is seeing when their children are gathering, their young boys. Because you can tell those who have boys and who play, you know who the leaders are. You can tell when they're playing that you can tell who the leaders are and who's making the decisions. But it's not only about who is making the decisions, it's about how they're treating the rest of them, that they care about the rest of them, that they're being looked after, and that they have an inherent as well, an inherent love and kindness. So there's that character, other characteristic as well of being that leader is not just leading them, but also caring about the rest of them. So they would know who that would be. And so they would watch them as they're getting older. And of course, part of our education system is you're teaching them as they're being born about their roles and responsibilities, whether they're male or female. And so, you know, you teach them as they're growing older, when they become, you know, when they become from girls to women and from boys to men. You know, when they're going through puberty and they have a responsibility of advising about their responsibilities, and it changes as time goes on. And so that was part of our education system, our social system, was to teach them about who they are and where they come from and about respect for themselves as human beings and respect to each other. And so those teachings were inherent in our caregiving. And because of the men and our partners would also carry that responsibility together and sharing that responsibility of teaching them how to love, basically. That's what, in our language, Gayanesrakgoa, means a great big love. And so it's about how you care about each other and about how, as human beings, our relationships with each other. And so that's how you teach them about caring about each other. So anyway, when they grow older, there's a whole ceremony of, which is also part of this teaching, is the condolence ceremony when they become chiefs, Hoyana. And so part of that process also is announcing who the clan mother is, who the chief is, and we also have what's called faith keepers. a male and female faith keeper or sub chief, or, you know, there's different language, different words to describe, but they're helpers, male and female. And that ceremony still exists today. So when you think about how ancient it is, and the, you know, there's always, you know, tobacco we burn, and ceremony that goes with everything that we do, is part of that acknowledging the spirit. And so we had a recent condolence with new chiefs and new clan mothers. And so when you think about how old that is and how we've been able to maintain that, is part of the strength and the resilience that we have had as a people to maintain that. However, there's things that have occurred, you know, that as a result of colonization and the impact of women, which is what I'll get to, because this is the real easy part. Talking about where I come from and my tradition and ceremonies is the easy part. And so that basically, when we talk about the women's nomination belt and part of this acknowledging our clan mothers, but it was also the relationship to the land and relationship to our territory as women. In English, they use this term title holder, but I don't really like that word because it's more about our responsibilities to our lands and our territory, and that women's connection to Mother Earth. Women and Earth, our mother is the same. When you think about the nurturing of our mother, the Earth, and the same characteristics of our mother in giving life, maintaining life, it's the same. And so that's part of the responsibilities and why there's a soul connections between our women and our mother, the Earth. And so that's part of the reasons why that high responsibility, not only of our relationship to the Earth, but also our relationship to the Creator. And why there's such a high honor to our women in that responsibility. And they say that it's obvious, that connection, when we give birth. When we give birth is actually a time when we can decide whether we can go on the other side or stay here on this, in this physical world. And the reasons why we stay, sometimes women don't, but we have ceremonies too, birthing ceremonies. And the birthing ceremonies also acknowledge that new spirit that's coming into this physical world, and also speaking to the mothers and the fathers about their responsibility to that new spirit that's coming into this physical world, and their songs, their ceremonies. And we still do that today. And so that's, you know, part of, very small, again, part of the one of the teachings of the Great Law. And within the Confederacy, Haudenosaunee Confederacy itself, there's 50 titles. There's five separate nations, Mohawk, Oneida, Onondaga, Seneca, and Cayuga. And each of them have different clans. And so, and the way the process was is they went into different territories and they identified clans or animals within that territory, which that was then the connection also between the clan and the human, that relationship, also a spiritual relationship. And so how we obtain our clans is through also through that connection of those animals. There's water, air, and land animals. So, and species. So that's how our connections were maintained, also through our mother, the Earth. And so, you know, that's a very short explanation of our connections as women. And so this other part is really hard. I actually did my master's in law degree. I'm a lawyer by trade. Don't hold that against me. I obtained my master's in law degree at the University of Saskatchewan and focused on international law and the great law of peace, and talked about how the great law is our international law because it organized nations and nationhood and the treaty relationships. And also talked about the impacts of colonization. So at that time, it was very specific to all of my people and the impacts of colonization. And I think that was in 2000 when I finally finished. And so from that time, it's been, okay, so what happened to the women? What's happening to the women? Because we are living in a very unsafe society. And why we are now having to deal with missing and murdered women in our communities. And it's not just missing and murdered women from within our territories. It's also non-Aboriginal men who are targeting our women. Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, is part of the reality of today. And so I'll talk a bit about the impacts of colonization. And I had to talk about the, you know, where I come from first, because it's so real. And because we still live it, and because it's part of who we are and part of our resilience. And so this is, how many of you know what this is? Same ones who know about the Great Law. This is called the two-row wampum, Goswenta. This is the relationship and the treaties of my ancestors between first the Dutch, then the British, and the French, and the United States. And so this was the original relationship that was established with those original colonizers. And as part of this history, part of the Great Law gave the authority of our chiefs to create external relationships. So there were hundreds and hundreds of these treaty belts, not only within our nations, but in other nations, where we created treaty relationships with other nations even before the colonizers came here. And it was, whether it was about we're going to share the land and the resources. There's one that's called a dish with one spoon, and that was a treaty relationship with the Anishinaabe within our territories, and that was about hunting, that we're going to share the resources within our territories. And there was also one made with the Mi'kmaq Nation, also in the East Coast, and that was also about peaceful relationships. And so all of these treaties were created even before the colonizers came here, which is why they created this one. And so again, there was always ceremony, there was always negotiations, there was always discussions. There was also a process of going into somebody else's territory where you already had that ceremony built even before going into somebody else's territory. And so this one, this Goswenta, is also was about ceremony. It was, there was a spirit attached to it. And so this line, these, the wampum belt, this, the whole idea of wampum, and where these were all individual beads out of quahog shell. And so they made these beads to create these belts. So you can imagine how long it would have taken just to create the beads themselves. And this, there was a spirit attached to every one of them. when it was created. And so when you're putting together something like this and that huge spiritual responsibility of these two nations coming together and the relationship that was supposed to be established. So this river of life, Gaswenta, is what this means, is a river of life. And this one side of purple represented the colonizers' ship. And it held their laws, their beliefs, their culture, their language, who or what it represented of who they were, their way of being. So that was part of this, that holding this, their values, their culture within their ship. And this other side represented our canoe. And our canoe held our laws, our beliefs, our culture, our language, our spirituality, our ceremonies. And that we would live along this river of life in peace, respect, and trust, and friendship. And so as a result, you know, that's also what these white lines in between represented, was about that relationship. And there's also three in between, three rows. And so that also represented that relationship between each other, that we would go along in this river of life, because there were a lot of prophecies at the time as well, that they knew these people were going to be coming into our territories and establishing that relationship. And so on this river of life, we would travel along this river of life and not interfering in each other's way of being. That we would continue maintaining our laws, our culture, everything that I talked about in the Great Law, and they would hold theirs. But we've always maintained this relationship. We've maintained the spirit and intent of this original relationship, but the colonizers haven't, and their descendants. This treaty now is now violated, and it's been violated since Canada and the United States and the Dutch and the French have existed here in North America. So that original spirit, the ceremony that was attached to it, we've never forgotten that. We've never forgotten that relationship. And so when I talk about Canada, Great Britain, of course, originally, and that relationship that they had with Great Britain, our ancestors, and that relationship that was established in creating peaceful relationships, and Canada being descendants of Great Britain through their laws and their customs, have violated this and continue to violate this because it still exists. And so when I talk now about the impacts of colonization and Canada specifically, that's when we start dealing with all of the negativeness, all of the impacts of why we're having to deal with this today, of violence specifically. And when we're talking specifically about violence, which I'll talk about in a minute, part of what I said earlier about language, there's old language. We have very ancient language. And so when I started investigating issues of violence, I asked, I'm not a fluent speaker, I asked our fluent language speakers if there was a word for rape, if there was a word for sexual assault, and there isn't. There is not a word that even exists. They said, there's a word for assault. There's a word for, you know, physical assault, But there isn't a word for rape. There isn't a word for sexual assault. So that tells me that it didn't exist. And I know that it didn't exist because of how our relationships and the honor of women in our culture, in our tradition, and how it was honored, how our women have been honored. And they would never do that. It's like hurting our spirit. And so, you know, in talking about that history, now, you know, we can start first by talking about our, just the impacts of colonization and the presence of another nation from another place. You know, there was disease, there was that relationship of killing off a lot of our people just because of disease and contact, just first contact, and how our populations dropped as a result of those diseases. We can talk about, you know, the impacts of the way governments and, well, before I get to governments, missionaries. The missionaries came with those early colonizers, and part of their role was to Christianize us, because they didn't believe that we had a spirit or that we had ceremonies that already acknowledged our spirituality. And so these missionaries would come. They'd actually learn the language and be part of the community. But their mission was to Christianize. And so they came here a long time before governments were established in Canada. And so when government was established in Canada, I'm going to like really fast forward it to 1867, when we're talking about the British North America Act. And the British North America Act was established to create the role of Canada or Great Britain in this place called Canada. And also the establishment of that institution, in knowing about this relationship, did not acknowledge it. And so in creating governments and the relationships that were established, you know, when I was doing my thesis, I read a lot about the history of the creation of Canada in this place called Canada, and how they studied our culture. They studied the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, and they couldn't figure out why, and this is a quote from Hansard, that they couldn't figure out why a bunch of old women had such a role in our communities. They didn't understand that. And so as part of their study, they also had to figure out how to get rid of us. So they focused on the women first, right? Because they knew that the women were so strong in our communities. And so they created the Indian Act. So first they created the British North America Act, Section 9124, specifically, where they govern automatically and unilaterally, all of a sudden, magically. They had the authority of Indians and lands reserved for Indians. And where they got that power, none of us know. Because all of a sudden, it was magically created. And that's where they start their history. All of a sudden, they have that unilateral power to control us as a people. And so in creating the Indian Act, which was then created in 1876, they then had authority in studying through that time how to get rid of women's authority or women's balance, our decision-making powers through our traditional governing processes. And under the Indian Act was this status, becoming an Indian. So defining us as an Indian. And there was a section which was and continued until 1985, and it's Section 11 in the BNA Act, later the Constitution Act, or under the Indian Act itself. Sorry, and so actually the Constitution Act continues under 9124 of control of Indians and lands reserved for Indians. There were treaties that were made as well. Don't forget about the treaty relationship, not only with the two row, but many numbered treaties that was established all across North America. And so under the Indian Act itself, in defining who a status Indian was defining a status Indian as the male head of the household. So to become a status Indian was based on a man, and who was married to that man, and children of that man. And so when I say that I'm Mohawk, Bear Clan, that's from my mother, my mother's side of the family. Mother's, 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 I can go trace it back to this. You know, our clan system was maintained, and that was part of our matriarchal system, was maintaining that process. I have this little card that I've been forced to carry under the Indian Act system as being a status Indian. And this little card from the Department of Indian Affairs says that I'm Cayuga with no clan. So that's supposed to be my father, right? But that's not even my father's clan or nation, because he would have followed his mother, who's Onondaga. So that's his father, my dad's father. And even he wasn't Cayuga, because he would have followed his mother. And so that's part of still, you know, generations later, how we're still being impacted by the Indian Act, which still exists today. In my opinion, it's one of the most racist pieces of legislation that exists in the world. There's no other type of legislation in any other place in the world. And so this Indian Act that was created, because they studied, and because it's also based on patriarchy, white men who came to this country and created laws, created legislation, had to figure out how to get rid of the women, our women. That was one of them. And so if at that time a woman who decided to marry a man, Let's pick on Akwesasne. There's a border that goes right through the territory. So if a Mohawk woman from the Canadian side marries a Mohawk man on the American side, she's no longer considered an Indian. She has no status, because under the U.S. law, there's no such thing as the Indian Act. So they don't have status under the Indian Act. So she would have been forced to move to the American side. That's one example. Another example is if a woman married another man, Native man, let's say she married a Cree man from the West, she was forced to leave her territory and move into his territory. She became a Cree. She had to be registered as a Cree. If she decided to marry a man from another race, for example, any man who doesn't have status, so a white man, Asian man, black man, if she decided to marry a man from another race, she no longer had status. She had no connections. She was not able to live in her community. She was forced to live in his, wherever he lived. And so when she was forced to live in his community, and under international law, that's called forced displacement. When you're forced from your own territory and your own community into somebody else's, when you can't live there legally under Canadian law, that's called forced displacement. And that's generations. This has been since 1876, that impact specifically. And so that was the attack on women. But women, again, were very resilient and very smart. They still maintained the connections to their community. Language, some didn't. So then they created the residential school system. Well, then let's attack the children. Let's get rid of these people because they love their children so much. And because it's being transferred, this knowledge is being transferred to their children. We can't seem to get at the women. Let's attack the children. And so I'm sure many of you know about the residential school system. The residential school system, again, in my opinion, was one of the most racist, legally genocidal processes of Canada and the U.S. It was a process legalized under the Indian Act of wiping, trying to wipe us out as a people, to get rid of us as a people. This is also a statement, and I'm sure in, you know, when we had the residential school apology, the statement of government at that time was to get rid of the Indian problem, to get rid of us as a people. You know, in my opinion, again, my trained lawyer mind, if we were to take this to the UN, you know, we talk about genocide and bringing Canada to the UN and, you know, hate crime, the whole definition of genocide and wiping us out as a people, the culture, the tradition, the language, because that was part of the process, was to also eliminate our language, forced to speak either French or English. And so in that enforcement, again, of legalized genocide, you know, that affected many generations. And it's still affecting generations. When we talk about the specific impacts of residential school and the tracing of violence, that's where we can trace violence to, sexual violence, where children were sexually assaulted in those schools, molested by pedophiles. They were beaten up physically for speaking their language, and I've heard so many stories of how people were physically beaten, whether it was by their hand or by whips or even studded whips, needles through their tongues, you know, very ugly, horrific stories of how they tried to get rid of our language. And the impacts on that, specifically on women and being mothers. So, you know, when you go into these schools and the impacts that that had had even on our mothers and our grandmothers, who had no choice but to send their children to residential school if they were forced to, because that was part of the Indian Act too, was it became a criminal offense if you didn't send your children to residential school or you tried to stop them. And so that was part of, again, of that process and of control, of oppression, of assimilation, of genocide. by sending these children to residential school and stopping parents and grandparents from sending them. And so, you know, again, there's been a lot of stories, and I know the product. I am a product. My grandmother was in residential school. The Mush Hole, they called it. The Mohawk Institute in Brantford. And so I know the effects of residential school and what it's had on my Mohawk side. My grandmother refused to acknowledge of being Mohawk. She wouldn't speak it. She was a very angry, cold grandmother. You know, when you think about grandmas and love and kindness, you know, that was part of what she didn't have. You know, she was stripped of that. She was stripped of that knowledge and that love and kindness. All of her siblings attended residential school, forced to. And so she, you know, anybody who tried to speak to her in language, and she knew the language, would get very angry. And so that transference of even of our matriarchal society was not transferred to my own mother. Fortunately, my mother was with her grandma, and she married a traditional man, which was my father. And so she was raised, or she learned about longhouse ceremonies through our ceremonies, which then was transferred. But I saw the difference. I saw the difference of my longhouse family and church family. My grandmother became very Christian. And so I saw the difference, even in how the family, my family, like my mom had 8 siblings. And so all 8 siblings were never raised in the community, or they married out, sorry. And so they all married non-native, and they moved to urban centers all across North America. And my aunts are also very Christian. And so, you know, I had my 70-year-old aunt who decided to come back home and learn about the ceremonies. And I'm the one taking her to our ceremonies and telling her what they are. And I thought, what's wrong with this picture? Because I should have learned that from her. But luckily, I mean, I can say that I was able to do that. And able to explain. And they would cry because they weren't raised with it. And the power of the spirit of those ceremonies. And it made me cry. The very first time that I talked about this was when I was doing a class at the University of Saskatchewan, and I did write about it. And sitting in a classroom at that time, and I was so easy to talk about this again. And as soon as I started speaking about the impacts, I just cried, and I couldn't stop. And so knowing how that had an impact on me is what I had to figure out now and being able to talk about. It still is very emotional. And talking about how, you know, those impacts specifically on our women. The issues of, let's say, just basic food, you know, the right to have food, basic nutrition. They didn't have food in residential school. They were starved. Many died of malnutrition. Many were buried behind residential schools or within the confines of residential school. We still don't know how many. That's still a question. In our ceremonies, everything was about food, feasting, ceremonies was food. When our people gather, it's to eat and to feast. And we always found a way to do that. And so that, you know, that was part, also part of our culture was food and being well fed. But in residential school, again, it was up to the women to make the food, even at ceremony time. So that, again, that was stripped in residential school. That knowledge, the making of food, there's a whole spirit even of making food and the responsibilities of women. The issues of mothers nurturing and love was not in residential school. So that was cut off from our mothers and our grandmothers. And so it affected future relationships. And how it affected our men in residential school, in that relationship with their mothers. And the strength of our mothers to teach them how to be good men was cut off. And the ceremony, the time that they were in residential school was, you know, it could have been from the time they were 2 even until they were 16. And so that's also during the time of puberty. And so we had really powerful ceremonies to acknowledge that time of change in our lives and to celebrate, especially the young women and the young men, because then it meant about, you know, giving birth, having the opportunity to bring life. And so there was an honoring ceremony for that. What they did in residential school was horrible. They didn't honor it. They actually made it ugly. They made it ugly, and they used varying different kinds of trauma and abuse. When a young woman changed into her womanhood, you can imagine what they did. And I don't even want to say it because it's so ugly what they would do during the time of her bleeding. They made it really ugly. And so that was taken away, many generations taken away from us in that teaching and that responsibility. They learned about violence, about abuse, about sexual violence. And so that cycle began of violence. And we can also, I think, that whole cycle of violence was also as a result of this violation. The bigger picture, you know, an abuser. Canada is an abuser. On the bigger picture of violent relationships, Canada is an abuser, and they've used their laws and their processes of institutions to create that and to continue it. They continue it to this day. The Indian Act still exists. And so that's part of, you know, this relationship that I'm talking about and how it has affected women specifically, and the role of women, the role of decision makers, of natural leaders in our communities. You know, the Indian Act system itself, in that definition of a status Indian, has really also had an impact on governance. You know, today a lot of our own men, a lot of our own chiefs in our communities have learned that patriarchal thinking. In my master's in law thesis, I called it Eurocentric diffusionism, where we've learned to think those Eurocentric values and beliefs so much that we forgot about our own. But we're also dealing with an oppressive culture, being an oppressed people. you know, as a result, I also know very personally about violence and being molested as a child. And then being in violent relationships because I didn't know any better. I thought I was supposed to be treated that way. Until I started learning more and more and more about my tradition and my culture and my language and ceremonies. And luckily, we still have those people who have that knowledge that taught me about how it was supposed to be. And in understanding that relationship of an abuser and being oppressed are the same. It's about control. It's about not having control. And so Canada has been able, through its genocidal policies and history, is maintaining and trying to continue that oppressive process and violent process. But our people are starting to light up. Our people are starting to become aware of that history and starting to become aware of the violations of that relationship, and they're angry. You know, when you start to understand, and I can relate to this, because when you become angry, it's almost like a darkness. It's dark to be angry. And when you get out of that darkness, when you get out of that anger, and you can see it, and you can see how it affects all of our people, you can understand why there's anger. The process of coming out of that oppressiveness. The same thing like in an abusive relationship, when you realize, I don't deserve to be treated like that anymore. I am supposed to be honored for who I am. And that is supposed to be taught to the men in our communities. And so being within that oppressive situation is probably what we're living in right now. It is what we're living in right now. And so part of trying to come out of this system is having to learn about the oppressiveness of the colonizers and the disrespect and the dishonor of our people in general, but of women specifically. And the young people today, and how that's impacting our future generations. You know, and I always think about, you know, and speaking to a crowd like this is asking a very specific question. Do you know in the land, the home you live in, whose territory it is? And if you don't know, and because you know this now, is to find out and to understand it. Because part of this process, again, is about educating. You know, I'm sure none of you learned about this in the education system, which is part of the problem and the control of government to not teach it. Because if we were all to know this, we would have really good relationships with each other. This is what would be maintained. The original intent of living in this lifetime together, respecting each other, trusting each other, and having that friendship and acknowledging our lives together. And so, you know, when I say that colonization, the impacts of colonization is that it still exists. Because we have institutions like the criminal justice system, the legal system, education system, the social system that is created by Canadian institutions. And so all of a sudden, we're part of that system. Well, how did we get a part of that system? Well, we were forced to. So part of what we are doing and part of what I feel is part of my responsibility is educating, for one, but also my role. What is my role? Which is what I'm also saying to you, is what is your role in this? You are descendants of this relationship. We've never forgotten that we're descendants of this relationship. So how are you descendants? That's what I would like you to find out and to educate yourself about how you're a descendant of this relationship. Part of it is learning about where you live. And if you live in Montreal, that's my people. So when I saw hands go up, there was very few about knowing about my culture and my tradition and my history. And so that's what I ask of you. And the other is understanding the impacts on women specifically and the relationship of our mother. Because right now we are living not only in violent times, but also in violent times towards our mother, the earth. And as part of our ceremonies, it's always about giving thanks. Our ceremonies are always, and it's for everyone, for every human being. It's not just for us as Indigenous people. Because that's part of our teachings, is as human beings, we have a mind that's different than any other spiritual living thing. And so the Creator gave us a mind to think and a heart beat. And that we have a responsibility as human beings to understand what that relationship is to our mother. Because if it wasn't for the nurturing of our mother, the earth, and something happens to her, and there's many signs of her responding. She hasn't even reacted yet. There's signs. There's enough signs there to tell us that we need to change the way things are. Part of that is also the relationship of how women are treated. And so that's why I'm saying there's a direct relationship of not only of our mother and how we're treating her and how she's being raped, things being taken out of her without giving something back. It's the same thing as women being raped and violated and dishonored and murdered, being wiped out. It's still occurring. And so, you know, in thinking about that relationship and understanding about how all of us as human beings are responsible for that, I always think too about our responsibilities as human beings. One of our teachings is that we think of 7 generations ahead. So when we think about the decisions that we're making today and how they impact 7 generations from now, is it a good thing? The decisions that we're making, are they going to benefit 7 generations? I'm a grandma now, very proud grandma. Mm-hmm. I have 3 grandchildren who are 6 months, 5 and 7. And 2 boys and 1 girl, and my daughter. She's bringing all the babies. But she, you know, in raising her son as well, is also learning and being able to advise about how he is raised, and the girls being respectful as well. That's part of the teaching, is how you treat each other. So in knowing about that relationship and how we treat each other, And thinking about seven generations from now and knowing myself that those generations continue, how the decisions that we make today are going to impact seven, because I know my ancestors did that for me. That was this seven generations ago or more. They thought about me when they were creating this. And so in that relationship of understanding, that's what I leave with you. And I'm going to end my presentation. And thank you for your listening so intently. Now that you have this knowledge, to share it. To share it with others, and also to to become our ally in this relationship. And that's a big part of how we're going to change things, is becoming an ally and understanding and teaching your children, teaching your families about that. So nyawa kua. Yeah.
So I'm going to open it up. We're going to open it up for some questions if anyone has any.
Yet. It's in the process. Well, I should say up here it is. I've been asked to get it published for a really long time, but after doing that, I started working, so I didn't have time. I haven't had time to do. You can find it, though, through the University of Saskatchewan Interlibrary. They keep a record of all theses.
What's the title?
It's International Law. And the Great Law of Peace. Any other questions?
Yeah, Sarita.
I can't see you. Okay.
Why don't you go first, Sarita?
I just wanted to thank Daniela for that presentation. I'm just wondering about reconciling the legal system that one has to go through to investigate murders, mm-hmm. is through the Canadian state and the cops, and the cops is the front line of genocide often. Mm-hmm. The RCMP is established on the killing of Louis Riel, and they have murdered thousands and thousands of Indigenous people in mm-hmm. these lands, and I'm just wondering, with the grassroots movement that's been able to pierce through the blackout that the Canadian government successfully has imposed on these issues, I'm just wondering how you negotiate that on a day-to-day level of, because you still have to work with them, and yet they're also part of the enemy system, so I'm just wondering if you could address that.
Yeah, I mean, that when I was talking about those systems still existing today and the systemic problems, that is a reality. What we are trying to do is to, again, it's about educating. I mean, it's a whole systemic problem. Part of what I feel needs to be done is a revolution, for one, that we need to, you know, really create a change through grassroots people and community people. The way that we have been trying to establish a relationship has been very difficult. When we created the Sisters in Spirit Initiative, it was supposed to be a relationship with Department of Indian Affairs, Status of Women, Canada, Public Safety, and the Minister of Justice, Ministry of Justice. The only ones included right now is Status of Women. They are the ones who fund this initiative. And so there is an intergovernmental committee that we've been reporting to, and reporting everything, you know, everything that we've been doing. This, basically, what I said originally was, with this government, is you are giving this money to us so that we can prove already what we know, which is what we've done. And so as a result of this, they're now going, hey, and they're also being watched by the UN. And so as a result of this, Canada has to report to the United Nations Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women within a year. You know, they usually report within 5 years. So they're on now on the radar. So as a result, I'm now meeting with the Minister of Justice, and I'm meeting with the Minister of Public Safety, and continue discussions with the Minister of Indian Affairs, and have a really good relationship with the minister responsible for the status of women, who also wants to address this issue on a really, really broad issue of addressing violence in general. And so, you know, we've been very successful, I think, in the way of bringing attention, because the money that we've been given for Sisters in Spirit is nothing compared to what needs to be done. I'll talk about that tomorrow, about how it was created and, you know, the what we're doing within the initiative itself. You know, we've already, and we've known that the gaps are there in community and families and just the justice system itself, and the fact that Aboriginal women are not included in public safety. So that's... that's been, and part of it is because we've been successful internationally in bringing these issues to the UN and meeting with these committee members. And I think that's the other way we'll have to go. But also as when I was saying allies, is you're also voters. Some of our people don't vote. So we don't have that kind of leverage, and we don't want to. I don't, because that's not part of my system. Part of that is that you can use that process in bringing that attention to your own members of parliament, and making that change even within where you live. And bringing that attention as to what are they doing about it? Do they know about it? Do they care? That's part of this awareness building, is addressing the societal indifference and the political will of this country called Canada. Because now they have a responsibility. They've done this apology. Now, in my opinion, they have to be accountable to that. And as I said then at that time, what are you going to do about it? It's fine and dandy to apologize, but what are you going to do about it? So that we can see that there's actual remorse, that they really believe they did something wrong. But not only them, also the churches. We haven't even had that discussion yet about the responsibility of those churches. So, any other questions? I think we've had one yet.
That was pretty close to my question, so I guess I'll just ask an extension, which is I'm wondering when they'll have to report to the UN, and if you're hopeful that there will be
genuine action on the part of the other ministers, like of justice and public safety, as you said, and what kind of tangible actions maybe they'll bring forward as opposed to just some kind of lip service?
I think reporting in a year, so I think this was just in January. So January next year is coming up really fast, which is, I think, why they were the ones to make sure that I met with them. So that's part of this process as well. They want to create a plan of action. So what that looks like yet is still in the works. The UN wanted a specific analysis of the numbers and whether it is a systemic racist issue. And so, you know, we've just begun. We're just at the tip of the iceberg in this and the responsibility. So I'll tell you another story. My cousin, who is Tashina General, she's the second from that side. She was missing in January last year, went missing, and she was found murdered in the end of April. And so this has become very personal. I mean, it was very personal because I was dealing with issues of violence and trying to help and, you know, meeting with families when I did amnesty. And so it has now become very personal. She was only 21 and she was pregnant. And she was murdered by a man in our own community, the father of her unborn child. And so you know that when I was talking about our responsibilities, and so that shows how far away we've become. And so that I mentioned that too because it was only 2 weeks after we buried her that I met with the first time with the Minister of Justice, and I was angry. I don't even know if I made sense, but I think he was like, yeah, he was. I said some very, very strong words, which is probably what was supposed to happen anyway. Everything happens for a reason. And so, you know, and looking at their responsibilities. And so now my own family member has become one of the statistics. And so, I was going to talk about that tomorrow, too, so, and where we're at with that. Yep.
Yeah, it's very strange because today I am mailing, this is an apostasy letter that I'm mailing to the church, so they take me off their list of being baptized because of this abortion thing that had just happened in Brazil and Sisters in Spirit and everything that I'm fighting for. Mm. So now I have to ask them to put my name out.
Yeah. Thank you for that, letting us know.
Any other questions?
Yeah.
A few years ago, there was a sustained discussion about the revision of the Indian Act. When I say a few years ago, you would be able to gauge the real timeliness of that, but I haven't. I am not here all the time. I travel a great deal, but I'm wondering what is happening more recently, and if you believe that any significant progress can be made within the structures of those law, that law, and if really its evolution is not one of it. Very basic initiatives and one of the basic projects for further.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so just to clarify, I think there's two parts of your question. One is the changes in the Indian Act. Is that what you were asking about?
No, the debate. It's a continues to be sustained debate about regarding the necessity to abolish the Indian Act.
Oh, yeah, there's a continued debate. There was a change in the Indian Act, actually. I didn't get to that in 1985, where they were supposed to eliminate the sexual discrimination in the Indian Act. They changed it. Thank you very much. Actually, I have another saying, but I'm not going to say it. I'll tell you if you want to know later. The sexual discrimination was they changed it so that women or people who lost their status in marrying out would become status. It was a second generation cutoff, so it was only the mother and children who regained their status. But it created levels of status. It's now 6-1 and 6-2, and 6-1 A, B, C, D, E. And so if you are a 6-1, anyone who was a status Indian before 1985 became a 6-1 A. So I'm a 6-1A. My cousins, whose mother married out, are 6-2. So, for example, my aunt who married a white man lost her status. She regained her status actually as 6-1C. She did not get 6-1A. And her children are 6-2. There's still sexual discrimination because her brother, my uncle, who married a non-Native woman, she became a status Indian, and so did their children, so they're all 6-1A. If a 6-1, or let's see, if a 6-2 has children with another 6-2, their children have no status. If, let's say, a woman who has a child, they may be in a violent relationship, she may have been raped and had a decide to keep the child, and she doesn't want to register the father, it's an automatic assumption by Indian Affairs that the father is non-status. So if she's a 6-1, her child is a 6-2. If she's a 6-2, her children have no status. And so eventually what happens is there's no status Indians left, which is the intention of the amendments called Bill C-31. And so that also there's this what's called unstated paternity as a result of not being able to or not wanting to register the father. And that's occurring with our young women all over. Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay.
I just want to know what's the Native Women Association's position on, so you're talking about status, but there's federal status and there's community status, right? So with Bill C-31, the government, some communities are controlling membership, so there are, like for instance, Glenwage, the women never regain status, ever. And I've even heard stories like chiefs telling them, well, if you want to get back on the ban list, kill your husband. And so I've been to a couple of these meetings with these women. And so what can be done about that? I mean, because when you speak to the people that are like, you speak to our chief, he's not a bad guy. You know, you speak to different people. Like, I can't say, like, it's not a black and white situation, good versus evil. It's something totally different, and you're talking about a grassroots revolution. I mean, the way I see it, it boils down to money. Who is going to get access to the very few dollars and the lessening pool of money and the growing pool of population that our communities are? So, from what I understand, and what I've been asking at the federal level, is that because of Gunawaga's stance on these women, and there's apparently something like 3,000 to 4,000 other people waiting to get back on the ban list that have to compete for that. So there's this like almost this fear, and and it's really not community building, which is what we need to do. It's something else. So I'm just wondering if you can give me advice, or what's the stance of the organization?
Well, again, the systemic problem, what was supposed to happen by the Department of Indian Affairs at the time of Bill C-31, 1985. See, the whole process of the Department of Indian Affairs is they control the dollar under the Indian Act system. So there's 652 First Nations communities, and there's, you know, funding from the Department of Indian Affairs into all of those communities. So after Bill C-31 and the amendments to the Indian Act, and knowing there was going to be an influx of people coming back to their communities, there was supposed to be negotiations for increase of reserve land and for programs and services for the amount of people that were going to be, that didn't happen. So that, what you're talking about, created the internal conflict in our communities because of the control of the Indian Act and the band councils and making decisions of where that money is going to go. And so also part of that thinking within our own communities after Bill C-31 was that bands were allowed to create their own membership codes. And so some bands have very strict membership codes, which is what you're talking about. And in some communities, they're not as strict. So in order to become, you can actually become registered as a status Indian under the Indian Act, but not be a member of your community. And so there's two processes this time that's built in into Bill C-31, is being registered, but in order, the next step is also being a member of your community. And so if membership codes are restricting people coming back to their community, and it is about the dollar, because it is about programs and services that need to be extended to all members of the community. The whole, when I was talking earlier about the Eurocentric diffusionism, that we've learned that mentality and that thinking, it's like they can't get out of that box that we've been put into under the Indian Act system. And so in order to come out of that, you know, if we were to go back to our matriarchal systems and basing all of our membership codes on our tradition, because not only is it based on the matriarchal systems, but there was also a process of inclusion, right? There's a process of inclusion of human beings, of humanness, of kindness, of love, of, and so creating these processes, which is what women need to do. The women are being excluded, right, from the decision-making. So it's the women and their support of the men to be able to make the change. And to me, that's what I'm calling part of the revolution, is a lot of our own women in being oppressed, not feeling they have a voice. You know, when you're in an abusive relationship, you don't have a voice. And so when you start coming out of that and you start having a voice, and this Eurocentric diffusionism, when women start having a voice, they think that you're, you know what, a bee. Yeah. So anyway, that's, you know, part of the change, part of the shift. And part of it is just educating our own people. Because a lot of our own people have not the knowledge that I've even presented to you because of that oppressive situation. And so it's not only educating within mainstream culture, and you know, it's also within our own communities. But doing it in a good way. You know, that's part of, I think part of the success that I've had is being able to say things factually. This is a fact. You cannot argue fact. And so if you present things that are fact, this is what our culture says. This is what our tradition, this is what our law says. This is what the great law says. You can't argue that. And part of that transference of education or the transference of that knowledge, you can tell when things are done in a good way because people listen and the light bulbs go on and you can see them go on. And so that's part of what I think in our own communities needs to occur, and the men need to listen. That's part of the difficulty in that Eurocentric diffusionism, is that they forgot how, and our own women. We have women who are abusers too. We can't forget about that. But that's part of that system is teaching that. I hope that answers your question. Okay. Yep.
I don't know where it's from. It's a new community. And a few years ago, I was listening to something that two people from the outside of the thing, that a very good thing because they were now having a sport, competitive sport from community to community and teaching them combativity. My emphasis is not very good. But to me, it's not a good thing because it's not your what you have learned from your nation when you were young. It's more cooperation, and and now they are teaching them to know, you know, and I feel that it's very important that they will need, be teach where they come from and to be proud of, mm-hmm. like you are right now when you are speaking. And this one other thing that struck me so much when I, it's about of the Canadian Act, Indian Act. When we think that Canada is less now, but was known as the best country in the world, and we have the Indian Act here, I feel it's such a great denial about the reality, and it doesn't make sense at all. So it means to me that so many people don't want to see or don't know because they never learn, and you are doing such a great work because the more people we know, the less they will be able to deny, and they will have something, something will have to be done about that. I feel so ashamed, I feel so much shame that here in this year we still have this type of act here. Mm-hmm. It's incredible. So yeah. I'm very happy, and I'm very proud of happy that I'm here today to listen to you.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. Yep, you.
I really want to thank you for your talk. I think a lot of people here are having a pretty strong emotional reaction to it. And I'm feeling very sad, but also very angry.
And that's good.
You mentioned, I think it is good, you mentioned about the darkness that comes from anger and the kind of rage. Very self-destructive. But I think anger can also be a great motivator. Mm-hmm. People get things done when they're angry. And I was a teenager in Vancouver when a lot of these people were missing. And there was a feeling of, what can we do? The police were not listening. There was no organization that would track women and what was going on. There was no way of knowing where they were, what was happening. And it was such a lost, victimized feeling, and I think that the anger that's coming out now is good, and it's strong, and you talk about Eurocentric ideas, well, women being angry is not a Eurocentric idea. Women expressing their anger is not. So, anyway, I'm mad.
That's good. I'm always angry. You can't believe it. But again, it is, I mean, when you have that emotion, that's not a negative thing, to be angry. To have anger is reacting to what has occurred, which is a good thing. But it's how you deal with it. You can either deal with it in a negative way by attacking and the rage, right? Or you can deal with it in a good way by being constructive and positive in making the change of why you're angry, which is why I do what I do. And so if I've made you angry, I'm glad. Because but don't be angry at me. Because your emotion is your own emotion. And if you're reacting to what I'm saying, whether it's in a negative or a positive way, it's your own emotion. And it's your own reaction. And so this is what I've learned as a result of being abused. And so that my rage, when my daughter ended up being abused by her own father, is I wanted to kill him. So I felt that rage and hate. And I picked up a gun to kill him. Luckily, somebody stopped me. So I know what that rage is. You know, people who are involved in OCA know what that rage is. So it's how you deal with it. It's how you address it in a good way. And that's what the Great Law was about. Was about peaceful relationships. So that's why I'm saying, if you're angry, why are you angry? Where is it coming from? And what are you going to do about it in a good way? So thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
And by the way, there's a petition here that Bridget, her mother is Gladys Tolley. Her mother was killed by Quebec police. She was hit on the road in Kitigan-Zibi, and they did their own investigating, and of course nothing was done. And so there's a few organizations, we're coming together to support Bridget and her request for an independent investigation into the killing of her mother. And so we have a petition that I think she's gonna have here for you to sign. And Kevin, this is Kevin Daniels, who is the leader of Congress of Aboriginal People, is our first signatory. So again, this is again a systemic problem. You know, they did their own investigating and nothing was done. Okay.
There are no more questions. I just want to say greetings to you. I'm from the Mohawk. My name is Cheryl Daigle. I'm with the Bear Clan. Unfortunately, our representative couldn't make it here tonight, so I was asked to present you with an urgent brief that we're going to be presenting to Parliament again for a second time on Wednesday, April 29th. Reestablish our identity. It addresses issues, human rights and environment issues. We intend to affect these policies, and we would like to create an alliance with all the people because the environment and human rights does affect everyone. So I'll just hand you a copy, and if anyone's interested, I could I'll say my email address is mohawktraditionalcouncil@gmail.com. So if you want any more information on that, we could forward you a copy of the brief and any more information that you want to know, we could answer your questions. So please.
Okay. Okay, good. Is that it? Okay, thank you again.
If any of you are interested, I think Bridget and Sue are also selling T-shirts and other various things to raise money for the Sisters in Spirit campaign in that corner.
For